LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that have been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Available September 13th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Imagine doing a talk show, and it's Wednesday, and it's 5:30, and the show starts in 3 hours, and you don't have a guest yet. I don't think any of the newer hosts have had to experience that.
For Jimmy Kimmel, launching his late-night show on ABC almost 14 years ago was a struggle. Now, Kimmel talks about being a grizzled veteran and his plans for hosting the Emmys, which includes writing hundreds of jokes, but not an acceptance speech, even though his show is nominated. But first on the News Banter, the high cost of ending the Roger Ailes era at Fox News. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my associate in banter, Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Kim.
So Fox News is, from a journalistic point of view, a gift that keeps on giving. So this past week, we have Gretchen Carlson settling. Roger Ailes, as you obviously know, the founder, the creator, the very soul of Fox News, has been dismissed because of Gretchen Carlson. He was paid $40 million to go away. She now has settled for $20 million. These are her claims that he was inappropriate, harassed her sexually, dropped her contract because she was unaccommodating. $20 million to her, so that's 60. There were two other women. We don't know what they got. We know there was another one previously that got more than $3 million. So a very costly exercise in purging what Fox News's parent company now acknowledges was a toxic, disrespectful culture. And, you know, when you read stuff that is written about it, notably by Gabe Sherman of New York Magazine, the mind does, in fact, boggle.
Yeah, yeah. And in some ways, perhaps 21st Century Fox got off easy because that seemed to be just the peak of the iceberg in terms of just the allegations against Ailes, and not only Ailes, but this corporate culture that he created with so many other execs, many of whom are still there, some of whom are now running.
Some have been promoted.
Yes. So this possibly is not the end of it, but at least the major head has been chopped off. And the big question now going forward is, what does this mean for Fox News? What does this mean for Roger Ailes, who, as we know, is now consulting with Donald Trump? And if Donald Trump does not become president, there are all sorts of rumors that perhaps they band together and launch a rival ultra-right-wing news organization in the coming months.
Yes, by all accounts, there is a sense of, you know, still ongoing turmoil at Fox News. The New York Times this past week published like a list of on-air talent, you know, Sean Hannity and a bunch of others who had publicly supported Ailes. It was kind of extraordinary for them to highlight those people. One of those people, Greta Van Susteren, already out the door. And
right.
The question is, who else?
Yeah, yeah. Greta Van Susteren exercised an option that said once Roger Ailes leaves, then she can leave as well. She decided to do that. And the Murdochs wasted no time in saying, all right, here's the door, here's your exit, just leave. So they're also, really wanting to clean house rather quickly. I mean, this was very swift. They've learned a lot over the past couple of years on how to deal with scandals like this. And James and Lachlan Murdoch, now running the shop, knew that we had to act very fast. Now, of course, like we mentioned, they brought in two other executives.
Bill Shine, who at minimum appears to be, I would say, a major enabler of the misbehavior of Roger Ailes over years with a lot of different women.
Yeah, yeah. And Jack Abernethy, who's also been a part of that camp and was a Roger Ailes lieutenant for many years as well. So to some degree, maybe the culture still remains. So this is a story that will continue.
I think the shoe will drop. I cannot imagine a world in which they survive. But on the other hand, look, you know, some people thought James Murdoch wouldn't survive the hacking scandal in Britain. It looked really dark for him. And he is now more than survived. So who's to say? You know, one thing I will say about those Murdochs, they seem to do what they want and get away with it a lot.
Teflon. Yeah, they are the Teflon executives. And Fox News is sort of the Teflon network. And so ultimately, we'll see if this has any sort of impact on the ratings and the ratings dominance that Fox News has had for nearly 20 years.
Now, looking at other TV networks, the fall season is about to launch. One thing that you wrote about this past week, which is causing some bumps, is the unbelievable noise of this year's presidential election and the many, many things that are scheduled that will preempt programming.
Yeah, elections are tough every 4 years, but this year, of course, is unusual because we're all paying attention to Donald Trump. It's the reality show that's bigger than any other reality show on television. And with so much noise and so much attention being paid to that, ultimately, there's not enough room for people to really pay attention to any of the news shows. And so awareness is down for news shows. And at the same time, like you mentioned, it's tough for these networks because they have to preempt constantly for debates, for election coverage and other things going on. So it's a staggered fall. And it's really posing some difficult challenges for the schedulers who strategize things in prime time.
And the marketers, you know, we're seeing some shows that are this constant Hollywood thing, reinventing things that used to be, Lethal Weapon, MacGyver, all these shows.
Yeah.
You know, Hollywood, the movie side, got beaten up a lot of studios badly this summer trying to repurpose stuff. And I wonder how, you know, is this going to work for the networks?
Well, it's tough. It's damned if you do, damned if you don't, because if you're the networks, again, no one's paying attention. No one's heard of any of these new shows. At least they've heard of MacGyver. They've heard of Lethal Weapon. So that allows for some awareness. They haven't heard of shows like Pure Genius. I bet you haven't heard of that show, Kim.
I admit that I have not.
That's a medical drama coming to CBS this fall. It's not original IP, so as a result, you've never heard of it. So that's the struggle that marketers are facing at the networks.
One that I have heard of is Pitch on Fox, which is the first woman Major League Baseball player. And I'm sort of intrigued, Mike, because I think maybe at the upfronts, I was talking to someone from Major League Baseball, and they said that this is not a far distant reality. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, and they're all in on this show, and they're going to use the playoffs to really promote this show.
They're all in on the show and maybe the first Major League Baseball female player.
Yeah, art triggers real life.
I hope so. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety. Jimmy Kimmel's days of struggling to book celebrity guests are long over. Now, one of the signature segments on Jimmy Kimmel Live is Mean Tweets, in which celebrities happily read outrageous insults that have been hurled at them on Twitter.
I'm getting f***ed up tonight. I mean, Patricia Arquette's teeth f***ed up.
If that gross, ratty old man, George Clooney, can find a girl, you regular fellas out there in the Twitterverse must be drowning in
f***. Jessica Chastain looks like Julia Roberts' ghost. I like that one.
Kimmel started out at small market radio stations, eventually landing in L.A., Longtime fans of the Kevin and Bean show on K-Rock will remember him as Jimmy the Sports Guy in the mid-1990s. His TV career started in 1997 as co-host of the game show Win Ben Stein's Money on Comedy Central. Michael Schneider, host of KCRW's podcast The Spinoff, recently sat down with Kimmel in his office after a show taping. Jimmy Kimmel Live isn't actually live anymore. Kimmel said long before he got started in radio, he was obsessed with late night and David Letterman in particular.
It was my identity as a junior high and high school student. It was like some kids are into heavy metal and some kids are into football. I was into watching David Letterman on TV. And I had a little group of friends who also loved David Letterman. One of them is my band leader now, Cleto. And we'd talk about the show every day at school, and I actually watched it become more and more popular and spread to other people outside of our group and become the kind of phenomenon that it became.
What was that like going up against your idol to be on at the same time and to be a competitor?
I think I somehow put that out of my head. I mean, I know that that is true, and I know that that's how it was from the very beginning, but almost like a hooker, I managed to disassociate from that. And now it's clearer to me now that, yeah, I was a competitor to Dave, but I never really, to me, Dave was like a mountain or something, you know. It's like there's not something that I could ever put myself, you know, on any kind of equal playing field with.
And now it also must be so interesting to sort of still be here, and he's no longer a competitor. You are the next generation, and in some ways, does it feel like the baton was passed?
It feels like the baton was passed over, and I got hit in the head with it on the way, is what happened. You know, it's funny because I feel like, you know, I've been on for a very long time. I don't know how much longer I'll do this job. And I almost feel like I was somehow one of Dave's colleagues or something, you know, like if Dave, Jay, and I are like the old guard or something. It does feel like that sometimes.
Really? You kind of feel old guard now. I mean, obviously you're one of the veterans, you know.
I am.
You and Conan,
it's
basically.
Just me and Conan, yeah.
What's that like to now be an old grizzled veteran?
It feels right. I felt like an old grizzled veteran when I started. I was exhausted from the get-go. I mean, it was nothing like I expected it would be. It was murderously difficult. We had no guests. I mean, imagine doing a talk show and it's Wednesday and it's 5:30 and the show starts in 3 hours and you don't have a guest yet. And you're calling people that you kind of know, asking them to be on the show. That adds a layer of pressure that I don't think any of the newer hosts have had to experience that. Yeah. I don't think anybody's been in that, because at that time, you know, there was just Dave and Jay. There wasn't anything else. And we were like an alien force that had been dropped into the mix, you know. And I was coming off the Man Show. Most of the publicists were terrified of me. And most of the celebrities had no idea who I was. So I was forced to rely on a small core group of celebrity and semi-celebrity friends over and over and over again.
Yeah, I was worried about you over the, you know, those early, whenever you had Corolla on, I'd be like, oh, it was another tough night for
Believe
Jimmy.
Believe me, it's very grateful when Adam would show up to save me over and over again.
Well, let's fast forward to this landscape now. I mean, we talked about Letterman leaving, but obviously we saw this big shift in the last couple of years with virtually every show changing hands, both on cable and on network. What did that mean for you? Did you see an opportunity?
I don't know. I never really saw it as an opportunity. The truth of the matter is, in the past, you had a choice. You could watch NBC at 11:30, or you could watch CBS at 11:30, and then we came on the air and you could watch ABC. But now no one ever has to make that choice anymore. You know, besides DVRs, everything's on the internet. So this idea that we're competitors, we all are competitors and we compete for the same guests, but that's primarily where the competition ends, because there are many people who manage to watch everything they want from all of these shows all the time. It's like buying a single from an album. You know, you don't necessarily, it's not like, oh, I only have $8 and I can buy one album. They can have everything, and they do have everything. And no one is forced to choose between our show and Fallon and Colbert. They can have all of that, no problem.
Well, now it really is all about watching the clips the next day and what's going viral. And of course, you kind of started that whole viral thing way back.
I take zero credit for that, but it did start with the Matt Damon video that my ex-girlfriend Sarah Silverman did.
I'm f***ing Matt Damon.
She's f***ing Matt Damon.
I'm sorry, but it's true. I'm f***ing Matt Damon.
And then we followed it with
the
Ben Affleck video. Title is profane, but most people probably know it.
I'm f***ing Ben Affleck.
This is Ben Affleck.
Call you another.
Those were definitely the first viral videos from late night television.
Yeah, and that was right around when YouTube was just starting and people finally actually could watch video online. But that was accidental.
Totally accidental. And at the time, we didn't even have a YouTube channel. Everybody was posting it on their own YouTube channels. And it was bothering me because some of them were blurry. Some people were shooting the video with their video cameras on their TV sets. And really, the reason that I decided we should consolidate and have our own YouTube channel was because I wanted the quality of the videos to be good. I wanted to make sure the intro was on a video if it needed it. I just wanted to make sure it was presented in the right way. And now it's become something that will probably wind up cannibalizing our show and maybe even our network.
Does that concern you? I mean, it seems to be working okay, this sort of uneven balance of, you know, how many people are watching live as a linear broadcast versus how many people are watching online. But at some point, does that cannibalize the show?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is television ratings are just going to get smaller and smaller and smaller, and the internet is not. For me, I'm okay with it because I'm 14 years in. If I was in my second year, I would be concerned about the long-term prospects of a job like this and being able to keep a big staff and to be able to put on a top quality show, because as the revenue gets smaller, you're really going to have to give something up.
Well, what's it been like in general this year, sort of reacting to this campaign and the absurdity of this campaign? In some ways, is it easier to make fun of what's going on, or in some ways, is it harder?
It's been great. The way in which it is harder is that everyone's talking about the same thing, so you really have to find an angle that you feel like hasn't been milked. And so that's the part that's hard, but everybody knows Donald Trump. Everybody knows Hillary Clinton. And all you can ask for as a talk show host, or I think a person who does topical comedy, is that people know the story. Because the last thing you want is to have to sit there and tell people what you're going to make a joke about. Give them the backstory. You want these stories to be familiar to them already, so you can just focus on the punchline or your angle. And with Donald Trump, we certainly have that. Every single day, everybody knows who he is, where he's coming from, a little bit about his temperament, or maybe a lot about his temperament, and it just makes it easier to tell more jokes.
You know, some shows have gotten, you know, done a deep dive into politics now, and you know, that's the strength of some shows. How do you kind of balance that? How political do you want to get? And sort of maintain the humor and not go too deep into that world?
Boy, for me, I can go however the wind blows. I mean, some nights, on occasion, I will get very serious. I mean, there are a few things. I did a piece on global warming that I took very seriously, and I wanted it to make some kind of an impact. I felt like there was a common sense angle there that is not being expressed enough. I did something about vaccination once that I was kind of a similar thing. And then, you know, you have nights where the focus is on Donald Trump's hair, you know,
yeah.
And I like to mix it up. You know, my show is not The Daily Show. I'm not Jon Stewart. I have a broader angle, I guess, or I don't know, a broader area of interest. We touch on more things. We, you know, that's part of our show, but it's so are our sports and so is entertainment. And we try to touch upon all of those things.
ABC, what's the relationship like with them these days? Do they kind of keep you alone for the most part?
I have a very good relationship with them. You know, we bumped heads at the beginning, and there are times always that, you know, we have disagreements or we don't feel like we're getting enough attention or whatever it is. But for the most part, we just kind of figured out, you know, where their line is, and they figured out where our line is, and we just kind of stay in between those lines. And sometimes stupid things happen. I mean, we had a drawing of a stick figure, a female stick figure that had two dots. Where, I mean, this is a stick figure, mm-hmm. and they made us blur the dots out. And yeah. For me, that's a gift, because my commentary on something like that is going to be better than whatever it was we had planned with the stick figure. So, you know, I kind of, I'll parlay that into something bigger when something like that happens. So they've learned not to do things like that, because I make a bigger deal out of them than they would like.
Right. And I know they've gone back and forth with This Week in Unnecessary Censorship over the years.
We did. With that, they've given up on, and yeah. We've won that fight. But yeah, but that was a crazy thing. You know, we bleep out words that aren't curses.
I'll tell you, it's a historical fact. The economy does better when we have a d- in the White House.
I have the biggest d- of anybody running by far.
To the Hispanic community, I get it why you don't like us. I mean, who's going to vote for somebody who's going to d- their grandmother?
There was a long period of time where they were saying, like, you have to bleep out more of the word. You can't do that. And I kept saying, these are not curse words. There's no reason we should be bleeping them anyway. That's the point of this bit. And that, I don't know, there's, sometimes you feel like you're screaming at the wall.
Coming up after a short break, Jimmy Kimmel shares his tips on how to host the Emmys. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're listening to a conversation with Jimmy Kimmel, host of Jimmy Kimmel Live. Kimmel is also hosting the 68th Primetime Emmy Awards, which will air on his home network, ABC, on September 18th. Kimmel's show is in contention for Outstanding Variety Talk Series, but it has been nominated for the past 4 years and has yet to win. By now, Kimmel has hosted everything from the American Music Awards to the ESPY Awards to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He first hosted the Emmys in 2012.
It was a big year for cable. For the first time ever, none of the four major networks were nominated in the drama category. And you can't ignore that. The Academy is sending a pretty clear message, and that message is, show us your boobs.
What did you take from all your hosting experiences with those kind of award shows, but especially in the Emmys, that you might apply this time?
Well, it's funny. You really do learn. It makes perfect sense if you think about it. You do learn from doing something once. That's really a big part of it, is figuring the audience out. Like here at my show, I have them pretty well figured out, even though it's a different audience every night. Mostly they're tourists, and mostly they've, you know, gone online to get tickets for the show a month in advance. They don't know who the guests are when they sign up to see the show. And I just kind of know their mindset. And I think I now understand the Emmy audience. First of all, half of them are celebrities, and most of them just want to know if they won or not so they can relax, or, you know, and either win and go on stage and get that out of the way, or lose and go drink or go home, right? You know, so you have to keep all that stuff in mind.
It's such a thankless job, though.
You know, I don't think it's a thankless job necessarily. You have to do a great job for people to give you any kind of credit, but there is something fun about it. I mean, all the TV stars are there in one room, and there are a world of possibilities. And I think as far as like speeches and presenters go, it's the best show, because you have people who do this for a living in that room, and you get to see, you know, a guy like Ty Burrell, who gives the greatest speeches every time he wins. And you don't necessarily get that at other awards. You certainly don't get that at the music award shows. And the Oscars are, I don't know, they have so much gravity that it seems hard to have fun there.
Is there much preparing that goes into hosting the Emmys now? Or, you know, you do a monologue every night, so is you know, it's a muscle that you know well. Do you need to prep all that much?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of preparation that goes into it. And I have all my writers from the show working on the Emmy show, so we're doing our show at the same time. And it's because I want it to be great, you know, so you wind up throwing out 1,000 jokes, you know, and you can only do 15 of them. So that's the hard part, is figuring out which jokes will really play, because a group of comedy writers might have a different mentality than America, you know. And so you really have to figure it out. You have to figure out the mood. Sometimes bad things happen in the world, and it casts a shadow over the show. So a lot of it is fortune, but I tend to be very prepared when I do something like this.
And obviously you like to do pre-tapes, a lot of stuff leading up to that. And you're at the same time doing stuff for your regular show too. So how do you fit all that in your schedule?
Well, I've been mailing the regular show in for the last couple of weeks. there's a lot of extra work. I just try to jam it into the weekends and before and after the show.
Yeah.
But we're pre-taping something that I think is very good, and I think people will like it.
Well, you're nominated as well. So, congratulations on that. Interesting year for this category, obviously, because you know it's been dominated by Comedy Central shows for many years. Those shows are nominated this year, so it's kind of wide open. Do you paying attention this year? You feeling different about this category?
No, I mean I don't have any expectation that we're going to win. I won't be disappointed when we don't win. I shouldn't even say if we don't win. It's nice that the Daily Show Colbert Report Death Grip has been released. But in a way, it was also kind of comforting because you never felt like any pressure to win. And
did you ever write a speech?
Never.
No?
No, never. Nor will I this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really, that's the thing. The pressure of giving a speech is not worth winning. It's like, you know, remembering to thank everybody, and I would agonize if I forgot somebody important. So I don't go in thinking that I'm going to win. And so far, I've been 100% right.
I remember talking to you 4 years ago, and you said, maybe another 10 years. So
yeah,
that would leave 6 years.
Where are we then? I don't know. I mean,
you're still a young guy, so
yeah,
you could see doing this for what, another decade, another 15
years? No way, not that long. I don't know. I have 3 years coming up on my latest contract, and I guess maybe the last year I'll see how I feel about it. I have this fear that, you know, I look forward to retirement. I just want to go fishing, and I don't want to work 11 hours a day, you know, so I think about it a lot. And, you know, I want to buy a house in like Wyoming or Montana or something like that and just go there and hang out. But I have this little voice in the back of my head that goes, once you stop doing this, you'll miss it. And it'll be the worst of both worlds for me because it'll be a lot of work and hard and I'll, you know, slog through it while I'm doing it. And then I'll have this false memory of it being wonderful all the time, and I'll feel bad that I'm not on television anymore. But I don't think I will. I think I'll be very happy with retirement or semi-retirement.
I was going to say, I mean, full retirement, or you could see yourself maybe doing a different kind of show, perhaps, or
maybe you're producing shows, writing, that kind of thing.
Well, the other thing that you've been a good corporate citizen over the years.
That's
too.
True. Thank you. What do you mean by that?
You know, in promoting Shondaland and sort of, you know, being a, you know, a part of that. You know, I guess it goes both ways. It's sort of quid pro quo.
It does, yeah.
But
I will only get involved in the shows that actually interest me. I mean, I was obsessed with Lost, and I talked a lot about that. And you know, Grey's Anatomy is a good show, but it's never been on my must-see list, even when it was hugely popular. And I do remember at the time, our network president, Steve McPherson, was really annoyed with me. He's like, why don't you talk about Grey's Anatomy every night? I was like, well, because, I mean, I like Grey's Anatomy, but I love Lost, and that's really what I want to talk about. And so my wife and I get very involved in The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, and I actually gamble on Dancing with the Stars, which if you bet on Dancing with the Stars, it makes it a whole lot more interesting. I won more money on Dancing with the Stars than I ever won off of sports.
Huh.
I, you know, you can bet on, you know, there are websites that will allow you to bet. And I'll bet $1,000 every year I pick one of the dancers. And it's really kind of fun to watch it happen. I won $12,000 one year. That's, you know, I don't know how you could be anything but thrilled about that.
I guess last question, what would you say is the biggest change over the 14 years for you and for the show? How's it evolved?
I think confidence is probably the biggest change. I was so nervous when we were on the air live and when we were putting D-level guests on the show that I would sometimes forget the guests' names during an interview. You know, things that you do when you're nervous and feeling rushed and having to watch the clock because you have to hit the commercial breaks at the right time, mm-hmm. which is part of the deal that people don't really think about. And I think now I understand it. Sometimes we'll have good shows and sometimes the shows won't be so great and you just have to accept that. And of course you try to have great shows every night if you can, but yeah, I don't feel like it's the end of the world when I don't have a great one. And I feel confident every night that we can at least put a decent show on.
Well, Jimmy Kimmel, host of Jimmy Kimmel Live on ABC, thank you for talking to us.
It's my pleasure, Michael, and happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from J.C. Swadek and Kat Yore. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.